eluding the police, and I run into your car, and then I keep on going, your insurance is going to take care of that damage.
Yes, as long as you're driving your own vehicle, or not a stolen vehicle. If you're driving a stolen vehicle, of course, there is no insurance tracking with you at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Does any of the committee members have any questions? Representative Bond.
Quick question. If there's insurance on an auto, but a person is driving it as a stolen auto, then there's no insurance coverage if there's damage. Is that what you just said?
I can't hear what you're saying.
Well, that's because I didn't make my question clear.
No, because I couldn't hear your voice.
If there is an auto that has insurance coverage for the normal drivers, someone else steals that car, goes out and wrecks it, the normal owner cannot get it repaired, is that what you're saying?
No. The normal owner is not legally responsible for the damage caused by the thief while driving the car. However, if the car has physical damage insurance on it, then that coverage still applies.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Bellamy.
Basically, what you're telling us is that in the cases of the damage done, it's pretty well up to the owner of the property to carry the insurance. Criminal situation. The guy steals your car, takes it out, and runs into somebody's house. The homeowner better have had insurance himself in that case.
Yes. The insurance company, his own insurance company, would pay for the damages and then attempt to collect it back from the culprit. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope this doesn't have a chilling effect in terms of your visiting us.
No, bills of interest, I always come in and listen.
Okay, we'll close the hearing on 2261, and we'll move on to House Bill 2337. Sheriff Foster.
Yes.
Anybody want to ask me about my budget?
We know you're short of money.
I'm Chuck Foster, Sheriff of Marion County. I'm here to speak on Senate Bill 2337 on behalf of the Sheriff's Association Legislative Committee. Simply stated, we're opposed to the legislation as worded. There are a number of reasons why we're opposed, and some of those surround a general statement that appears to be a rather simplistic approach to a very complex social issue. It seems to legislate conflict between our law enforcement entities, federal, state, and local, and it seems specifically to conflict with the oath of office that most law enforcement officers are compelled to take. Beyond that, I would like to make a comment personally. Without knowing specifically what the authors of this bill wanted, I can surmise. And I believe there are some problems. And I believe that it would be appropriate for the legislature to address those problems. I don't believe, and now I'm speaking for myself as opposed to the Sheriff's Association, I don't believe that this piece of legislation will address those problems. I have had personal disagreements with the Immigration and Naturalization Services policy and tactics. I believe that that's where the issue ought to be dealt with, and not with our local law enforcement officers and placing them in the middle of what is obviously a national social concern. To enact this piece of legislation as it is now, you would effectively tell our law enforcement officers that their oath of office doesn't mean anything, or it has less meaning than what most of them assume. They are required under oath to support the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the State of Oregon, and all the laws thereof. I think this piece of legislation violates that oath of office. I would encourage a resolution to Congress to deal with problems that I think this legislation is attempting to address. I think that's probably enough said. I know there are other people who want to speak to this issue. Are there any questions?
Counsel.
Sheriff Foster, do the Marion County Sheriffs have a policy in terms of cooperating with the INS?
We have a policy that requires all officers to cooperate with all law enforcement entities. I have a policy implemented in the office that they do not go out of their way to investigate undocumented aliens.
When you say you would like to maintain the status of your oath of office, when you say you want to enforce state and the U.S. Constitution, do you want to enforce more than criminal laws? Do you want to enforce civil laws?
I think that we're obligated in law enforcement to enforce all laws. And granted, there are some civil laws as well as criminal laws that are the same shade of gray. I think once we start isolating the limits of which laws our law enforcement officers shall or can enforce, I think we are beginning to tear at the fiber of law enforcement.
Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead, Counsel.
Well, currently, right now, if a tenant in an apartment did not pay his or her rent, without a court order, you couldn't enforce that law, right? The landlord-tenant law?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But that's same with many of our other criminal laws. We are required to seek a complaint and get a warrant, if you will.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sheriff Foster, it's my understanding that currently the local enforcement, law enforcement agencies do not have the authority to enforce the immigration laws, and that what happens is that INS comes and makes a request to you to help them on a raid, let's say.
That's correct.
Is that your understanding?
I would hasten to point out they seldom come and ask my office for assistance.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have stated that you have some problems on occasion with some of their policies. And in looking at this bill, well, when there is a raid, do they have their own radar equipment and radio equipment, or do they use the sheriff's, your equipment, or how does that work?
They have their own, as far as I know, own radio system. However, usually what they're asking for is additional people power to carry out some task. But again, I hasten to add, Mike, that for whatever reason, they seldom ask my office for that kind of assistance.
Do they reimburse your office for use of officer's time?
No, I think they would if I allowed the officers that. I don't have enough officers to help them anyway, but they were my closest relationship with INS is the jail. And they reimbursed me for jail space. I frankly probably am considered difficult to deal with as far as INS because I will not lodge, although I have to be very careful. The law requires me to lodge all federal prisoners. If an undocumented alien is arrested for a local offense or a state offense and brought into jail, and INS places a hold on that person, once our local offense is dealt with, I put a very short time frame upon which INS is required to come and pick up that person or resolve that issue. it's probably considered by INS that I'm not very cooperative.
Okay. Let me ask this question. If you are, or do you know, maybe from Washington County experience or here in Marion County, whose radio system do they use when there is, when they're, you're asked to help with some of your officers?
I really can't ask that, Mike, because since I've been in office, they haven't come and asked for a raid like that. Now, I could envision that if they were to come and they convinced us that a group of undocumented aliens were involved in some other criminal activity, such as narcotics, mm-hmm. prostitution, and that's not unreasonable. We may actively go with them, use our equipment, our staff, if we felt using the INS violation, quote, mm-hmm. would be an appropriate way to bring resolution to the bigger, in my opinion, much bigger issue of outright criminal activity, we would do that. And I would not expect reimbursement. Mm-hmm.
Is the now this bill is limited to the alienage issues only, and not involved in the narcotics or controls issues or any other criminal law. Is it? Do you know? Or although being a law enforcement officer, on the raids themselves, are they a dangerous situation for officers?
Again, I'd have to couch that with my experience is considerable with INS, but not in Oregon.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that perhaps the if you want to call it routine, converging upon a farm group of farm labor homes or shacks to gather in a body of undocumented workers, there's probably very little threat of personal safety. But I think the potential is always there because there is a predisposition by some of the undocumented aliens to be actively involved in the narcotics traffic. We currently have several in our jail now facing very serious, major narcotic trafficking activities. I guess it's difficult for me to provide a clear distinction between the two groups. Now, I would not participate in a raid upon a family of farm workers merely because they were undocumented. I would not participate. I would not expect any of my officers to, quote, report a family of farm workers merely because they were undocumented. I make a strong of encouragement not to report people who were brought into jail for relatively minor offenses that may be undocumented. I've done everything except write a specific policy prohibiting that because I don't think that I can, in good faith, write a policy that tells them that they can't fulfill their oath of office.
I see. Okay. Are there questions from other members of the committee? Council?
Just one, Sheriff Foster. If, for example, a local police agency helped INS and, let's say, put a couple of suspected aliens in their police car and the alien got cut in a police car, who would be responsible? Would there be a problem with that liability?
There would probably in my area because I've had problems with INS in the past. But they may be willing to provide the medical services. Typically what would happen in my office is if a person got injured, whether it was a cut or whatever, they would not be accepted in our jail until they were taken to the hospital. And if they were in custody of one of my employees or one of the sheriff's employees, then the immediate presumption is that I would have to be responsible for that medical treatment unless the individual themselves could pay for it.
Let me switch your suggestion on you. Right now, under some of the current case law and under the opinion of the Legal Counsel for Immigration, they state that their official policy is for local police not to enforce immigration laws. And what if I suggested to you that if local police did want to enforce immigration laws or did want to enforce income tax laws or did want to do civil law, that maybe they should go to Congress and ask Congress to grant them powers, federal powers?
That's a good point. I can cite a number of cases where we have actively gone out and enforced tax evasion laws, all of those that you talked about on significant cases. And maybe my response is, let's not kill the messenger. And I think that's what this, the way it's worded now, is tending to do. Let's not take any tools away from local law enforcement. Very honestly, I don't know of any agencies that have their people actively out attempting to identify and enforce the undocumented issue. They may use that as a device, just like we may use the device of income tax evasion to make a case for extortion. I may be naive, but it does not happen with Marion County Sheriff's employees. I think it's wrong. But I would not want to see a prohibition against our ability to enforce any law, civil, criminal, whatever.
Thank you very much, Sheriff. Mr. Neal? Sheriff Neal?
Seems like I'm letting Jeff. Sheriff Norman B. Neal, Douglas County. I'd like to testify on House Bill 2337. Douglas County, we have 5,089 square miles, and probably better than three-quarters of its timber, or timber that's being replanted. And the majority of this planting is being done by people that are being brought in illegally. And what I see this bill doing is restricting us back in a number of ways where we could very well have our woods working alive with these type of people and never leaving. So we do know where most of them are at. We're not out actively arresting them or bringing them in, but we do keep track pretty closely of where the tree planting crews are and who they are. Not intentionally, however, if we have a woods theft, which we have them going on continually with our logging shows, we respond to an area, and it's pretty hard to ignore what's there if you run into a crew of tree planters and none of them can speak English. And some of them will run into the brush, and you know what you've got. You've got a whole bunch of them that are there illegally planting trees. Part of the problem we have had, they work them clear up to the point that the job is done, and then the immigration mysteriously gets a call to come and arrest all of them, and they never get their pay and they're sent back without it. And we've noticed a real problem in that, and we have a couple, three contractors in our area that are doing this. And if anything that restricting this type of activity and legislation should be done, it should be against those people that bring them in and then see that they're taken back without being paid. But we have a number of them, and I foresee it hampering in our county that they may remain for an indefinite period of time. We work very close with the other agencies. They use our radio frequencies when they come in because we are a mountainous area, and our system is very adequate for the terrain we're in. And we may use our vehicles to assist them, but that one of the questions you asked, who would be responsible for that person if he receives injuries in that particular situation, and that would be the immigration authorities. And that would be kind of an oral understanding, unless one of my people was negligent and overreacted or something along that line, and then I would feel that responsibility would be mine. But I foresee a real problem that if this passes, that my people will totally ignore what's out there, and if immigration does come down, we'll have no information for them whatsoever, and they'll have to go do their looking on their own. As I said, we have a large county, and that could take days and weeks to look for some of these people if they so chose. We did have them working right in our quarters with us. We provided an office for them, but I guess in their cutbacks or whatever's happening, I think our closest one is either Eugene or Portland now. And they will come down when things get bad with a bus or whatever, and we will assist them in picking up whatever's there. If local law enforcement ignores these people, we'll find them camped on our rivers and with no means of support, and then eventually to feed themselves they'll need to steal from a property owner or whatever. And we have this through the summer months as it is now, and in placing this, I'm not sure that it would be the right direction to go. Any questions?
Yeah, Representative Bellman.
You're saying that you, the INS people, could come down there with a planned, organized raid. Your present position is that you may assist with where you have noticed activity.
Yes.
Second of all, they may actually use your vehicles.
If they do not have enough vehicles, then we will assist them with ours.
Does that mean that your people are actually driving your vehicles?
Yes.
So you're actually assisting with your officers too?
Yes. Because of the large population that comes in with them. And of course, I believe in working with all police agencies and assisting them with anything that's possible and legal. And as we continue to be fewer and fewer, I think the cooperation between law enforcement agencies will it's going to have to even get better. We have a very close working relationship with the state police and the city agencies in Douglas County.
Representative Springer.
Sheriff Neal, do you have any unsolved crimes down in Douglas County?
Yes.
Are you concerned that there are probably people driving on the roads in Douglas County who are under the influence of intoxicants that you're not able to arrest because you don't have enough resources?
We are doing quite well. Even though the new law on drunk driving and so forth has been enacted, it has not decreased our drunk driving arrests.
Still a problem for
yes.
you folks. If you were to go out and ask the people in your county what they thought was most important in terms of priorities, and none of us have enough money to do what we want to do here in the legislature, you and your department, that's just a given. We've got to prioritize our activities. If you were to ask the people in Douglas County what was more important, solving or devoting your resources to solving crimes or stopping people who've been driving under the influence or helping INS go out and collect round up illegal aliens, what do you think the people in Douglas County would say is most important for you to do?
Probably their personal property, and then the mad mothers would naturally be the drunk drivers, and the farmers and ranchers out in the rural areas are concerned. And then when you come back to the bottom point, each one of the illegal aliens that is there is technically taking a job for some of our 14% unemployment we have.
Kind of a mixed response, but
well, an administrator in law enforcement must look at the areas that he has problems, and of course those are given priorities, of course life and death being the first, and then down the line. But we're not actually solving a murder every day, not leastways not in Douglas County. We don't have that many, but we work adjust our manpower to the priorities, and I have manpower available, and I'm probably one of the few agencies in the state that has a large reserve group. I have 30 trained reserves that also assist us out in these areas, including I have over 100 search and rescue trained volunteers. And I believe very strongly in the reserve program.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever called up INS and asked them to help you out in enforcing your DUII laws? Or
no.
Just, I guess, a final question. In terms of the information that you gather about what you feel is unlawful practices by these forest contractors, are those contracts that are left by the federal government on their lands?
Yes.
Do you have occasion to share your information or beliefs that those contractors are violating federal law which prohibits the kind of practices you've described?
Yes, but perhaps you know, or your committee here knows as well as I, that a minority has priority on a bid with your government agencies.
So, despite your reports, there hasn't been at least no resolution of the problem in terms of enforcement of the federal or state laws as it relates to these kind of unfair contracting practices.
To my knowledge, there's been nothing done.
Okay. Thank you, Sheriff. Appreciate it.
Sheriff, just one quick question. If you were prohibited by state law to use your personnel in aiding in the INS raids, and the purpose of the raid was solely to round up undocumented workers, would if you were prevented from using personnel, would the INS not use your equipment at all, except maybe some communication network?
Well, our communications would be available to them, but I would probably be a little bit reluctant to release my rolling equipment to someone that I did not have control over.
Okay. Thank you very much. For the questions? Thank you. Mr. Alvin Allen, thank you for coming over here today. Welcome.
Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Alvin Allen. I'm chief of police at Staten, and I'm here today to testify against Senate Bill 2337. And I base that on a couple of thoughts. I feel that it would drastically affect the cooperation that local law enforcement has with the immigration personnel. And I think it would be very detrimental to law enforcement, especially in the communities where they have an influx of migrant labor during the summer months. And to expound on that a little bit, I haven't been in Staten all my life. I've been with the police department there for 8 years, 7 years, and prior to that, 13 as chief of police in a eastern Oregon town of Nissa. And if any of you are familiar with that country, it is a farming community where migrant labor come each summer from Texas to work in the field. And I found in those 13 years that a great deal of those folks stayed in Nissa and the surrounding areas. Their children went to school in the schools there. And wanted to come in to make their checks for undocumented workers, that it was a real advantage to them to have local law enforcement on their side and could identify folks in town that we knew because they were our neighbors that had lived there for 15 years. And as a result of that, immigration didn't spend a lot of time checking people that we knew didn't need to be checked. And I think this type of law that we're discussing today would take that away from those people in Eastern Oregon. I haven't been there since 1978, but I did make a couple of phone calls this morning to some police chiefs that I know in that area, and I would encourage you, before you take any action, to contact some law enforcement officials in Ontario, Nissa, Hermiston, and the sheriffs in those counties, and get their input.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Counsel?
Yeah. Mr. Allen, how many police officers in state and or in Eastern Oregon did you have that spoke Spanish?
I'm sorry?
How many officers, police officers, did you have that spoke Spanish?
When I left there, I had two Spanish-speaking officers that worked for me.
In your experience with working and cooperating with immigration, were most of the raids done on Hispanic or Mexican aliens?
Yes.
Were there any Canadians ever picked up?
There wasn't a, not that I'm aware of, there wasn't a large influx of Canadian people in that area.
Are you aware that approximately 15% of the illegal immigration in the Northwest is from Canada?
I'm not aware of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, I just have a quick question. You're currently the police chief in Staten.
Yes.
Does INS draft you folks or ask you?
I've never had any contact with INS in the 7 years I've been in the state.
Do you know of?
Except possibly 0.120, which is the last subsection.
I agree, and I think we will try to finish up work on this on Tuesday. Council,
I think they'd be. I think they should be ready by then.
Okay. Now, in looking at these amendments, is would these amendments address the situation that Representative Bellamy is talking about in terms?
Anita Paulson and Mr. Santos worked on these amendments, and we were trying to get to capture the tenor of what the committee was suggesting last time. I don't think they go as far as Representative Bellamy, and I'm sure Mr. Santos is here and could speak to that. I think he would be in full agreement with Representative Bellamy.
Okay. Mr. Santos?
Danny Santos, president of the statewide Hispanic Local Action Committee, testifying on 2336 in favor of it. As legal counsel has indicated to you, we took time since our last testimony on this bill, took the direction of the committee and simply tried to focus on the issue of public health agencies and those types of agencies, public agencies. The only comment I would have right now in response to Representative Bellamy's situation is I think one of the things we were trying to do was take away the affirmative duty of the agencies to report. And though the district attorney's office and my attorney would be able to exercise an option, I think that's a gray area that'd be kind of hard to outline as to when it's to be optional, you know, when it's optional and when it's to be exercised. But I think it primarily does focus in on what we were trying to get accomplished too. So,
okay. And looking at this, the amendments still repeal 415.110, and there may be part of 110 that we do want to preserve to address Representative Bellamy's concern, and I share part of the concern as well. Yeah. Counsel.
When we tried to do 110, we tried to redraft 110 was to rewrite that and include that in 120. That's what we're trying to do.
Okay, but the problem, as I see with 120, is that it takes a request from the immigration officer to kick in.
Correct.
And I think we want to be able to go the other way as well, so that if the local police agency want to on their own, instead of trying and sentencing and incarcerating an individual for a crime, they may want to just deport the individual.
Can I make a comment, Chairman? The practice now, we spent a couple visits to the Indian Committee Judiciary, went to the OSP several times, and we've asked the policy of the prisons. It's the policy of the prisons, if an alien is convicted of a crime and sentenced to 5 years, is to let them stay there for 5 years, and then after 5 years, release them to immigration. even if they're paroled, let's say after 3 years, the parole board notifies the immigration. Immigration says, okay, we'll pick them up. And sometimes immigration doesn't pick them up for several months. So they're staying, they're in prison for several months after they could be released on parole or sent back.
Okay.
This, my concern gets more to the fact that the DA in Jefferson County, when he arrests an individual that is a troublemaker, is causing problems even in the Hispanic community, he would rather just get him out of there. And that's when he wants to have the authority that once they've been arrested on a crime that has nothing to do with being an illegal alien, he wants to make sure that we don't write the law so it would prevent him at that point of calling up INS and saying, hey, I want you to check this individual out.
Mr. Santos?
I think we find a lot of agreements on that. Once again, it's just our only concern would be from how to put that language in the bill so that discretion is made known. That's how you're trying to exercise it, not such that anybody arrested, because I think we'd leave back in the same situation we had that brought this bill to your life, in life to you, in the sense that we had people that had to be, that were involuntarily committed, therefore basically arrested, and then do we turn around ourselves, find ourselves in an arrest situation, find these people turned over. So
for public health purposes, though, they weren't arrested for a crime. We could, I think you'd want to specifically state arrested for a crime.
Yeah.
Which would help. You bet.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing then in work session on 2336. And is Tuesday soon enough? Too soon? Or do you want to tell next
I think it's...
I think we'll have some things by then.
Okay.
I'll work with Representative Bellman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right along. House Bill 2127.
We're not disposing of many bills today.
Well, I've been voting yes on a lot of things. I'm tired of them. Bring up my average.
That's right.
The next full committee, the criminal sub, is going to catch up with this.
House Bill 2127. Number. Do we have any more paper related to this, Council? 2127.
We have a letter from Marsha Olemiller that's part of the record, and it's dated February 28, 1985. We also have a person from, her name is Marsha, from the Women's Faculty.
Women's Rights Coalition.
She's also present in the audience for questions.
Oh. Chairman, Representative
Bonds. On this bill.
Yes.
I don't really have strong feelings on the bill, but it just seems to me that the courts could afford the postage necessary to continue sending these notices. And really what we're doing is shifting what I see as a court function from the court to the petitioner. I don't really see why we should do that. Now, I have to express a bias that I represent petitioners often, and I'm not real excited about taking on that new role. So I guess in that sense I have a tiny conflict of interest. But I just really think it would be appropriate for the courts to continue.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I agree with Representative Bellman.
Well, I don't have, don't practice law, and I just had kind of a problem too. I guess it's a matter of we're talking about around $3,600, and the way the law is today, we're pretty much assured that people are going to receive these notices, and I have a question in my mind whether attorney may not and then provide the notice and then. Get into another area, what's going to happen to the adequacy, the sufficiency of notice, and the suit involved if he or she did not attach this notice.
Would you like a motion?
Sure would.
I need five, I think.
Five to table.
I just checked our rules.
What's your table?
Four. If I said five earlier, which I'm very likely did, I was wrong. Under our rules, page four, votes of four members in a subcommittee meeting are required to table a measure or take a measure from the table.
That's right.
does that mean that this will be listed in the calendar as tabled, or do we have to take this to full committee?
No, it would be listed in the calendar as tabled.
Okay.
Can we wait just one second for your motion?
Sure. You're in a position of power right now.
Relish that right in your quality.
There's always a position of power. That wig and robe went to his head.
Thanks, Stevie.
And I don't want you to look at Mr. Linden once when you're trying to make up your mind.
Do I gather that this letter is in support of killing the bill?
Yes.
That's not a harsh word. We don't want to kill it, we just want to table it.
That's right. It would always be available.
Next session.
Has a nice relating clause.
I think I'm ready for the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bunn.
I would move that House Bill 2127 be tabled.
Representative Bunn has moved to table House Bill 2127. Clerk, call the roll.
Bellamy.
Aye.
Bunn.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Kapetsky.
Aye. Motion passed.
Just used up part of that excess fee they're collecting from the district court to clerk's office.
That's one way of looking at it. Can we move on to, we're getting
keep
close.
Keep doing this, we'll be even again.
Fun stuff.
What? Can we keep doing this, we'll be even.
House Bill 2096. And Mr. Linden is here. Ms. Abrams furnished us a chart.
Oh, my goodness. We're back to the two heavies at the end of the day, Mr. Chairman.
That's right.
Representative Springer wants to carry this bill.
Oh. Well, it's either Representative Springer or Representative Bond.
You may know why I made the comment.
Sounds like a vote explanation.
Now this is judgments, right? Okay. I didn't know you could find a typewriter that small.
This is good afternoon.
It's pretty easy for the public to understand. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. Here to talk to the subcommittee again about County Clerk lien records. One issue that was left unresolved after the last hearing had to do with amendments filed by the state bar relating to enforcement and recording of foreign judgments. It's my understanding, I'm going to let the bar representative speak to this, that the amendments will be withdrawn and that he and members of my staff are going to work on some other amendments to address the issues that originally were to be addressed in the amendments you received last time. And I'm perfectly agreeable to that. With that, I think I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Cosgrove to comment.
One moment, please. Representative Bunn.
Could I also suggest there was evidently a concern expressed by one of the title company people. Could you also work with them to see, evidently they have some other legislation that somehow ties in or dovetails with this. And my hope was that if you could check with Rocky and work with them so that when you come back we have the whole package and don't have to go over it again.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
That's correct. I think if it has been mentioned earlier, I did have a phone call from Michael Magnus with the Oregon Land Title Company, and he advised me that apparently they have requested and apparently legislative council is working on a bill draft relating to the same general topic area,
and they would like to be included, I think, in any discussion or amendments in this area. If, I don't know if you've had some contact with them earlier, independently or not.
Hi, Paul Kaiser from the State Bar. I understand that the title companies have been interested in the same subject area, and there have been discussions back and forth. They don't particularly relate to the area that was covered by the State Bar's amendments. They relate, I think, to the bill as a whole, and I wasn't aware that a bill was being drafted at this point by the title companies. We will certainly be looking at that and discussing it. The State Bar's amendments were on a sort of related issue, specifically to federal court judgments. After you get them in the state, then the bill as a whole says you would file them in the judgment docket rather than the county clerk lien record. But it was the process that our amendments were addressing, was how to get a federal court judgment in the state court. I think the commission and the judicial department of the State Bar have agreed that perhaps the proposal in front of you with the amendments produced by the State Bar is not the best and most efficient way to meet that goal, and perhaps a better way would be to take a look at Chapter 24, which is the Uniform Registration of Foreign Judgments, and rework in that chapter a quick, efficient, economical way to bring federal court judgments down to Oregon State Courts. The agreement we've reached today is if the committee is willing to, perhaps if this group comes with a proposal for modifications to Chapter 24, whether it be part of this bill or perhaps a different bill, look at that issue after we've had a chance to do some additional work on it. And if that is true, if the committee is willing to do that, we would be withdrawing our amendments now to allow 2096, which is related but not necessarily tied together, hopefully to go forward through the legislative process. We're only concerned because the State Bar's proposal, which I think there's been a consensus reached on the goals and objectives of it, just not on the mechanics of it, it's only available at this point as an amendment to this bill, and so we're somewhat concerned about withdrawing that amendment if we aren't going to be able to bring it back in. Perhaps in a different bill.
Representative Bunn.
Just a question. As time goes on, it becomes more and more difficult to find a bill that is likely to pass that you can tap it onto. Are you satisfied that you have or will have a vehicle to use?
I think we've had a commitment with the Judicial Department that we'll be able to find such a bill.
Could I have that kind of commitment on about 5 days?
Well, I let me explain the rationale. 2096, I think the State Bar supports in its general trust, and we were using it to do something slightly different but very related, and we felt it was appropriate to make these amendments for workload problems as well as others. We don't want to delay 2096, independent of those amendments, it's a good bill. Our amendments we think are important. We've reached the commitment on the goals and objectives. We just now have to find the mechanics, and I think we'll be able to find those mechanics to bring it back before the committee, just dealing with that issue with the agreement of all three people here at the table.
I had 2127 in mind, but we'll find it. Actually, Mr. Chairman, we have a bill coming in relating to records management issues, and I think that may be the appropriate vehicle to
okay. Representative Bunn.
You don't anticipate any problems with that additional bill you just mentioned getting passed? There's no controversy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, it's a in many ways a housekeeping bill in the court records management area. There are really a minimum of policy matters included in it, although there are a few, and we'll be highlighting those for the committee. But generally, it's to standardize some procedures, conform practices between the circuit and district courts, and get rid of some archaic terminology, things of that nature.
Will it have a fiscal impact? Spelled Ways and Means
no,
referral.
I don't believe the record management bill will.
Okay.
Thanks.
I get bothered by the term housekeeping.
We felt our bill was somewhat of a housekeeping bill, but obviously it's not. Nonetheless, we think it's appropriate to look at it more carefully rather than produce something that's less good than we could otherwise produce.
Okay.
In this process, housekeeping usually means lots of work.
Spring cleaning.
Right. Spring cleaning.
Now, Mr. Linden, did you have something else you wanted to say about 2096? Or?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. You can stick around. It's fine. Ms. Abrams, do you have a little chart for us?
Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I tried to prepare a chart which outlines the basic concepts as far as the procedures that were involved pre-1983, under the 1983 law, and under the proposed House Bill 2096. These are just simply the procedures for doing the particular things outlined, the creation of a judgment lien in County A, and creation of a judgment lien in County B, the renewal of a judgment lien, and the filing satisfaction of judgment, just to give the subcommittee members a chart that they could look at to see how things were done prior to 83, the 83 changes, and what 2096 is proposing to do. It doesn't attempt to include everything that's done in the bill. It is merely an outline of the most basic of the procedures that are incorporated in the bill.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions on the chart? That can't wait until after the meeting.
Are you disposed to move this bill?
Not today. I think we have to hear from this. Yeah. Oh.
Well, could I ask a question?
Representative Bond.
Do you know, with the agreements you've made to work the amendments and other bills, is there any reason that this bill could not move out of subcommittee today that you know of?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Bond,
none that I know at all.
Representative
Bond. For discussion purposes and hopefully to move the bill along, I would move that the bill be passed to full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bond has moved House Bill 2096 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bellamy.
Without trying to understand this chart yet, House Bill 2096 leaves all of the judgments actually within the court process, right? The filing of judgments and everything else is within the within the court process. It's not within the county court. County clerk, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bellamy, that's correct. The one small area where judgments will remain in the county clerk lien record is the judgments that have been filed there under the 1983 law and until the effective date of this bill, if it's passed, which would be October 185. Those judgments that are in the county clerk lien record right now will remain there until renewed in the circuit court judgment docket or satisfied in the county clerk lien record. So those will stay there. Otherwise, all judgments after the effective date of this act will be in the circuit court judgment docket.
And the effect of this bill will be to effectively go in for that 2-year period and pull out of the county clerk's lien record the judgments that were filed and put them into the circuit court record?
No, it leaves those judgments that are in the county clerk lien record right now, it leaves them there. It doesn't touch them. It merely addresses what happens with future judgments.
Okay. Is it true that the title company would be concerned about that 2-year period, that means they're going to always have to be checking both the circuit court records and the county lien records?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bellamy, we had that same question in drafting the bill. Initially, we drafted it to require that all the judgments would be removed. We found in talking to some of the county clerks that would be a tremendous administrative burden because of their recording procedures and how they'd have to basically search it by hand to find the different documents. when we heard that, we checked with the folks from the title company. In fact, Mr. Magnus is one of the people that we kept in contact all along in the process of developing this bill. And they assured us, since they look in both places anyway, it didn't really matter to them if we left it there. They're searching the judgment dockets, they're searching the county clerk lien record, they're searching the deed records anyway. So it did not create an additional burden on them.
I think that's all the questions I have.
Counsel?
Yes. Ms. Abrams, if something is currently recorded in the county clerk lien record in County B for a County A judgment, in order to renew that 10 years from now, would you renew that in the judgment docket of County B?
Yes,
okay.
You would.
Okay, thank you.
The intent is to bring everything back into the judgment docket where feasible. The only thing that for the judgments that are in the county clerk lien record right now, the satisfactions will be recorded there. That seemed logical, but the renewals will go back to the circuit court judgment docket.
Thank you.
Further questions, comments?
Well, what did we do with the satisfaction fee? That was a question last time. Is it still left where there is not a fee for satisfaction of judgment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bellamy, the bill right now provides there shall be no fee charged for that. I had sent a letter over to the committee indicating that the fiscal impact of not, well, let me back up one moment if I could. We had a fee for satisfactions established in early 1983 at the time of state takeover. We found that the creditors and debtors were arguing over who was going to pay that fee, the effect of which was that many judgments which had been satisfied weren't having satisfactions filed. As a policy matter, the court system decided that the accuracy and currency of our records was more important in this particular issue, and as a result, we dropped that fee. Now, we estimated the biennium, if we had a fee set at $375, which was the amount of the last fee, you have a positive revenue impact of approximately $79,000. If you are going to include a fee for satisfactions, I would strongly recommend you also designate who is to pay that fee, along with the requirement that satisfactions be filed by the creditor when the judgment is actually satisfied.
Representative Bellamy, I think we did get a letter, at least I received one, to our offices on this matter.
So, but your bill, as presented, does not include the fee?
Representative Bellamy, that is correct.
I'm ready to vote.
Okay. Representative Bunn has moved House Bill 2096 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. We'll close the hearing on, thank you very much, on House Bill 2096, and we have House Bill 2016, which is a lot of fun. We have a letter from Ms. Stockdale, and we have another chart.
Would you like me to explain the chart, since it's my request?
You can explain the bill on the floor if you'd like. Ms. Stockdale, do you want to join us, please?
That wasn't quite the answer I was expecting. I have to think on that.
That's what you get for volunteering.
Thank you.
Loud, who is the Collection Division Legislative Coordinator for the Department of Revenue, he is the person who is responsible for the creation of the chart, which I believe should help you to understand the process of giving notice to delinquent debtors before legal action is taken against them to collect debts. Attached to the letter that I wrote to the chair is a list of the policy questions presented by Hospital 2215 as requested by the committee at the hearing on Tuesday. I've also attached a list of those agencies, state and county, that are authorized by law currently to issue warrants as opposed to administrative orders for the collection that I do. What's the chair's pleasure as far as the order going through these materials?
Why don't we, would the committee like to go through the collection process first? Why don't we do that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Loudon from the Collection Division of the Department of Revenue. What I have done for you is prepared a copy on the first page of a chart showing the current collection process as it exists now. And what we have done is taken two of the largest agencies in the other agency account program. One is the Health Science Center, the medical school in Portland, and the other is the higher education, which would be some any type of student loan. And what I have attempted to do here is show you the minimum amount of notice that would be given to the taxpayer. In the last hearing, the committee indicated that they would like to see what notices are sent to the taxpayer, so that when we get to the point of filing a warrant and issuing a garnishment, the taxpayer is well aware of that. So as you can see, going down the left side from the Health Science Center, that there is a very minimum of four collection notices that sent to the debtor prior to the account being assigned to the Department of Revenue. On higher education, you have a minimum of eight notices which are sent prior to the account being sent to the Department of Revenue. Now, this is just the billing cycle alone, excluding any collection action that they take. Once the account is assigned to the Department of Revenue, then we in turn notify the taxpayer that the debt has been assigned and the case is assigned out to a revenue agent in a telephone collection unit. If there's no voluntary payment, then we issue a demand letter for payment of the taxpayer. If the